Hey, hey, welcome to When Songs Mean Business.
I'm your host, Steph Belcher. Before we get started with today's guest, I want to let you know about a free virtual workshop I'm hosting January 10th through the 14th. If you've been playing small, if you've been accepting less than your worth, if you struggle with negotiating your rates or answering the question of how much you charge, if you aren't sure how to explain your value, or if you've been struggling to make ends meet, it's time to level up your business. Leveling up means that you're tired of playing the same game with the same small results. You're ready for new challenges, new collaborations, new resources. You want some recognition for your efforts and your achievements, and you deserve them. Leveling up means that you grow and you change and you stretch beyond the boundaries of what you thought was previously possible. It means making sure that you have the right tools in your bag to confront the big boss and beat him and move on to the next stage. Because here's the thing, the world needs you to complete this challenge because the world needs your art. We need your music, we need your videos and your books and your designs. They're unlike anything else that's out there. You tell a story that no one else can tell. And people need to hear that story. People who were just like you a few years ago. People who are trying to figure out how to overcome the things that you've already overcome. There's this whole group of people that already love your art and they want to support you on a deeper level. These are the people that we're going to reach. We're going to work together to do it. Most people cannot level up alone. They need help. They need boosters and extra tools. You need friends that are going to send you lives and bonuses when you keep getting stuck. You need a community of other players. You're going to give each other support and advice. That's why I'm opening this Level Up Your Business Bootcamp.
It's a free 5-day workshop. It'll be an hour a day, Monday through Friday, January 10th through the 14th, 2022. I appreciate you all so much for listening to this podcast and supporting me and my classes. And I would love to see all of your beautiful faces on Zoom for this free workshop. There's a sign-up sheet on my website and in the show notes here. Today's conversation is super fun. I'm going to be talking to my good friend, Nate Durow. Nate is a talent buyer at Audio Tree Presents and the creator and host of the Here For Now podcast. He is also the vice president of the Michigan Independent Venue and Promoter Association. He's a huge supporter of Michigan music and creativity. He is a proud husband and father. And as you'll hear in this podcast, he is a collector of cassettes and Legos and shows and so much more. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Have a wonderful day. Check out the Level Up Your Business Bootcamp, January 10th through 14th. Sign up on my website. Thank you.
Hey, buddy.
Howdy. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Doing good. It's good to see your face. It's been a minute. Yeah.
Thanks so much for doing this.
Of course. I got my Legos. I got my tapes over here. I got
Yeah. Go. That might be a good place to start. Tell me about your tape collection.
Oh God.
What prompted the collection, like the collecting part of the collection?
I guess I've always had the collection like bone in my body, so to speak.
Yeah.
Honestly, booking is like a kind of an addiction type thing. So my family has a lot of addiction. Positive and negative, probably mostly negative in the past. I latched onto it pretty early, and I guess that would be from like good parenting, you know, to like realize that we have this tendency. So I collected baseball cards when I was a kid.
Oh, cool. My husband did too. He still has them all in a box in the basement.
I gave most of mine away. I have one little binder over here now that has like all my favorites. And then I just gave the rest away, which is crazy how much money I spent on them. And then to just hand them to somebody who still cares about them, but they just don't have the value that they did. I didn't collect them like as a psychotic, like money grubbing type person. It was just like to have them, you know?
Yeah.
So I've always had that. I collected bootleg, like live bootleg CDs.
Nice.
For a while, not only CDs, but also like digital copies. So I would like go on Napster and just download like all these bootlegged like concerts and stuff. And
nice.
Just a bunch of different stuff like that. And the tape thing just started a couple of years ago, though. I walked into a record store in Flint called Jack's Record Stash. And it was co-owned by this dude, Jerry, and Brandon Trammell, who used to be in this band called Kid Brother Collective. Okay. And basically, long story short, Jerry's father, I believe, or Jerry's friend's father was like a hoarder of records. Like he had over 100,000 records in a collection.
Whoa.
And so they made his dad passed, and the records were passed down to this guy. And the guy knew Jerry as like a record collector, and they decided to turn Jack's collection into this store.
Oh, cool.
And then with that, they also bring in like, you know, newer records and things like that. But they've got this base of 100,000 records that they're still going through. This is like 4 years later.
Wow.
They're still going through all these records. So I went up there and I walked in, and they had this wall just like this with these are Napa Valley 100 case. They're like these nice wood holders that everybody had back in the day. And there were
my dad had some.
There were three of them stacked up on the wall. And in those like early on in Jack's record stash today, as you walk in, and it was like all these old hip hop, 90s alternative, all the shit I grew up on. Right.
Yeah.
And I just freaked out. I was like, oh my God, there's tapes. I have that tape and that tape and that tape. And like, so this one right here, and I know people aren't going to be able to see it, but like this Alice in Chains tape with the cool yellow case.
Yeah.
And the purple tape.
Oh gosh, what? The sound of you opening the cassette tape and pulling it out.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I love it. They had this one, and this was one of my favorite albums of all time. And I pulled it out and just did exactly that. I just like held it in my hand.
Yeah.
And I used to mow the grass in the neighborhood with that tape. Like I have memories of that cassette and the Stone Temple Pilots purple album. I didn't even have tapes that long. I probably had tapes for like 2 years. And then I eventually got a CD player and then had a million CDs and then had them all stolen out of my car a couple of times.
Oh, yeah.
Like we all did, you know? But I just was like, oh God. And it like hit like all of the cylinders in my, like all of the circuits in my brain were just going crazy. And I didn't buy any that day. I was just like, I'm not going to do it because I could buy 50 tapes off this wall right now and go home and tell my wife I spent $500 on cassette tapes. But it just like stuck with me. So I started looking around, and then I went to Dearborn Music, and they had a decent little tape collection, not nearly the same, but they had a Gin Blossoms record and a Bush record, the one like 16 Stone record.
Yeah.
And they were like $3 each. It was like the gateway drug, right? So I grabbed them, and then the next day or next time I went to a record store, I bought three more and then five more. And then I figured out there's this whole internet community, as there is for everything, right?
Yeah.
So I just started collecting them, and now I've got something like 400 of them, and it's too many, but I've got all of them. You know, I've got like almost everything that I ever could want. And then, you know, I still find some rarities every once in a while. I'm like, wow, but
Do you have a cassette player?
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a little, I bought like a rack mount, you know, old school components cassette player with the record player and the receiver over there. So I don't, you know, I don't play them a ton. It's an ownership thing, and it's nice to have it. It's just my desk is right here. And then just to my right is like my collection of fun, you know, and it grew within the pandemic too. Like, it was like this comfort thing, you know, surrounding me with my stuff while I'm locked in my house. And that's why, you know, I've got all my backstage passes up here and my records over here and my Legos up on the wall here and pictures of my family and my, you know, just stuff.
Like if I'm going to be stuck in this room, I'm going to have all my favorite things in here too.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah,
for sure. So
I feel that. During the pandemic, I'm going to turn my computer so you can see too. I have so many wires. Can you see that corner back there?
Yeah. Those shelves? You know, I did see you had posted something about that was like an unused space, and you turned it into this little like record collection spot.
And I have all my dad's records. My mom moved. Well, so like, I remember this day so clearly. It was Christmas Eve. And we came home, and the window over the kitchen sink was open.
Oh.
And the house was cold. And my dad went downstairs, and all his favorite records had been stolen. My dad had collected every classic rock record you could possibly think of. He had all of them. And they stole, like, you know, the Beatles' White Album and Dark Side of the Moon and like the ones that would have been pawned easily.
Yep.
But they didn't steal like Fleetwood Mac and Emerson, Lake and Palmer and, you know, like the deep cuts. So I still have all those. My mom moved out of our second house. And then my dad like never really unpacked them. they were still like in the boxes in the basement from mm-hmm. when we moved into that house. And then my mom moved out of that house 20 years later. And I just like took the boxes. I was like, all right, these are mine now. So yeah. I have this like epic record collection that we never listened to, you know, but I remember making tape copies with, you know, we had like the dual cassette. Mm-hmm. And I would like rip tapes, like New Kids on the Block, and then like mm-hmm. take them to my friends at school and be like, shh, don't tell anybody, but I copied this New Kids tape for you.
Yeah. No, I did that, taking it to another level of shh. My mom would buy, you know, she worked at a Christian bookstore. So she would come home with things like DC Talk and Audio Adrenaline and all this stuff. And I was always like, Mom, I don't want this stuff. That's not what I listen to. But then I would take tapes and put like Baseball Game on them or something. But in reality, they were like Snoop Dogg's Doggy Style and Dr. Dre's Chronic. But I would label them like Tigers versus Royals, 1989, May 13th or something. Because I would occasionally record a game off the radio, you know, while I was at school or whatever. So I had all these baseball tapes, and then I had these like rap tapes that I wasn't allowed to have that I had labeled different things. So
that's hilarious.
And then I would end up with like, you know, some of like the stuff that's a little safer, you know, but even my mom would be like, Alice in Chains, that sounds terrible. Why is Alice in Chains? What's wrong? Is she okay? It's like, well, I mean, she's in chains, so maybe, I don't know, but you know.
I wonder where that name did come from, what it means. Never thought about that before. I've literally never once thought about that.
Yeah. I don't know. I actually just, I just listened to, there's another podcast called Tell Me All Your Thoughts on Pod. And it's a 90s. It's just like three dudes that like listen to either an entire record or an entire discography with a band from the 90s, but they're not like big fans of it. So they kind of like listen to it for the first time together. And there's an Alice in Chains special that I just listened to, and it was kind of obnoxious, honestly, because they were just like tearing this band apart, you know, and kind of like, I like that song, but that song was garbage, and you know, all those kind of things. But they didn't really get into like, they read a lot of Wikipedia facts, you know, while they were doing it, but it was mostly focused on like what they thought about listening to the song for the first time. It was an interesting premise, because I would love to do that with like friends and just like pull somebody into my world and then make them do that for me. Like, all right, we're going to listen to these 12 songs together and just talk about like a book club, but like in audio. Yeah. In audio form. And I know you've been doing that a little bit on your side with more new tracks.
Well, so I'm having people play their songs.
Oh, okay.
And get feedback from them. It started in class and as a way to get to know the students, because I wanted to know what they were listening to. It gave me a point of reference for what they thought was good music, basically. Mm-hmm. So on the very first day of class, in all of my classes for 4 years, that was the first thing that we did. Was I was like, okay, let's go over the syllabus, and now we're going to have a listening party. So you get to pick one song, and it will do two if we have time for it. And I want it to be a song that you feel really strongly about. Either it like defines you, or it defines your sound, or it's just like your favorite song right now. But you know, we don't know each other, so make it a good one.
Right.
And it was always so interesting. And it was nice too, because I usually taught the freshman domestic music market class. So this is like the first week of school, and they're just meeting each other for the first time as first years. And
you're just cracking open their soul in front of everybody. Yeah, like, let's get into it. Let's get deep, y'all.
Yeah. Yeah. Like lifelong friendships were formed on those days, you know, where it's like, oh, you've heard of this band? I didn't think anybody had heard of this band, and now you're my best friend.
Right.
So that was really cool. And then, so I started doing it. I taught continuing education. And so I did it then, and they all played themselves. And I thought that was really interesting, because my freshmen didn't even have that as an option, really. They didn't have anything recorded, you know. A couple of them did, but most of them didn't. So I liked that. I thought that was ballsy and cool. And I was like, good on you for taking this opportunity to get up in front of a room full of people and play your own music, like that has, there's some like heft behind that, you know? So I thought, let's do this. I want to like present this opportunity for people to get in front of at least one music business person who's going to give them honest, kind, thoughtful feedback about like what we're listening to, you know? And it's been very interesting. It's honestly, it's hard to get people to do it. It's a lot harder to convince people to play me their songs than I would have expected it to be.
Sure.
They're shy. They're nervous, you know, and like they don't, I ended up putting one of them up on YouTube so that people would see that it's not necessarily like an intimidating
it's not
process.
Brutal it's
yeah,
not like,
yeah,
it's not like trotting them up in front of Simon Cowell and getting made
yeah.
fun of or whatever. Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's not like that at all. It's really not. It's more, you know, it's more of like, these are the influences that I can hear, here's some fan bases you could potentially tap into. Like I had one guy play me a song and I was like, this is really great and I don't want you to take offense to this, but I could hear this being remixed by a bunch of DJs and being like a 12-minute long house music song, like in a club. And yeah. He was like, that's exactly what I want to do with it. And I was like, oh, good. Because right. I was worried that you were going to think that I was ripping it apart. But it's been very fun, very interesting. I'm meeting a lot of people. I would really like it to be a big thing. You know, like I would love if one day I logged into a listening party and there was like 100 people in there and everybody's in the chat talking about what they think of the song. But also sometimes it's really great if it's just like 5 of us. So.
Right. Right. We'll yeah. At a certain point, it loses its intimacy and becomes yeah. sort of vulnerable on maybe a negative level, unless
exactly.
somebody's really confident, you know,
yeah.
Last thing you need is for one person to ruin the whole party by being a jerk about stuff like that. So
right, right. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, Assemble does, that's a big part of what Assemble does with their residents is like the song listening nights or whatever they call them.
Yeah.
Where they bring their people in and they all just sit down and.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a sure. Motown thing too.
Yeah, sure.
They talked about it in Hitsville. And what I thought was really cool about it was that like the newbies did it and Smokey Robinson did it. And it was, everybody did it, you know,
yeah.
like, and I think it's such a cool way for people to learn from each other.
Right.
And I would really like it to be, you know, oh, that part sounded really cool. What kind of production method did you use on that? And, you know, those are the kinds of conversations that I want to have with it, but we haven't quite gotten there yet.
Yeah. As with most things, the following for it takes some time to develop and
yeah.
you know, have a consistent turnout. Because if it's just like you and three people every time, it gets tired, you know, real quick. And that,
yeah,
that's everything. I mean, that's everything from, you know, streaming.
Yeah. To shows,
to whatever, you know, it's like,
yeah.
you gotta continue to spread out and it's a difficult thing to do for sure.
Yeah. But I'm going to keep doing them and I'm going to, you know, prioritize the coaching clients that I have right mm-hmm. now. Because I know them and I'm offering it to them as a service, you know, like,
right.
Play me what you recorded this month and let's talk about it. And I'll give you some polite feedback and not in a Simon Cowell way.
Right. Right. I'm not going to bury the stake in you that
yeah.
quickly.
So you probably hear a lot of new music in clubs, right? And coming across your desk, trying to get booked.
Yeah, it was funny. We were joking about that today in the office. We had a pretty good marketing call with my team. Well, it was three of us in the office and then the one that lives on the other side of the state zoomed in. And we were really getting pretty granular about our marketing efforts and things like that. And I kind of made a joke of like, a couple of different times of ultimately, like, it really doesn't matter what we do for marketing. If I book the right shows, people are coming. And if I don't, they're not. And we talked about a couple of shows that had surprised even me when I got there, and I was like, oh, this is what this band sounds like. And I'm like, how did I market this show for 6 freaking months, book the show, offer them money, and not even know what they sound like, you know? Yeah. But it's like, it's a mass thing. I mean, the volume is insane of just how many acts are out there. Yeah. And at a certain point, you read the press clippings, you know who sold it to you, you know, from talking to other promoters, like what they're worth and what rooms they did in other markets, and you just make the offer. And then sometimes you just forget.
Yeah.
I like to pride myself on like never getting too surprised, I guess, by what it is that I booked. But I also like, it's not as much like an audition through email than you'd think it would be, you know, like, here's the song, here's my single, here's a live video, will you watch this and judge it and then book me? It's like, it's more like, did you go through the process correctly? Did you approach me in the right way? Did you feel like you had a plan? Did you, you know, all of like those things, if you check all those boxes, sometimes I don't want to say take the music for granted, but I definitely have moments where it's like, I get to a certain point and like, what is it that I booked? I should figure this out, you know? And it's 2 months after the show's gone on sale or whatever. And I'm like, oh, this is a little different. And there's just so many tools available to tell you, like whether it's looking at Spotify, like related artists or, you know, there's Chartmetric and all these, like, we signed up for another one that's Chartmetric today that just compiles all the social data and gives you all these related artists, and you might like this if you like this kind of thing. And I can just like paint a picture, you know, like, oh, I know what this band is. But like Larkin Poe this weekend, who's a Grammy nominated artist, I knew they were kind of in the folk blues, whatever world, but it was a rock show. And I thought I had booked like it, you know, it was in a seated church out in Grand Rapids at Fountain Street Church. And I thought I'd book more of like a folk duo that had accompaniment, you know, and then they got up there and just ripped. And the crowd was like 60 on average, which was wild. I didn't see that coming at all, because the last play that they had in the market was an L Club.
Oh,
so it was like, why, you know? So they sold out L Club, and then the next tour they came back and did Grand Rapids, and they had grown from that point with the Grammy nomination, and then COVID hit, and you know, so the show didn't do as well as we had hoped. But like, it was one of those things where I was standing up in the room watching them just tear it up, and I'm like, I don't even know if I know who this band is, and I've been marketing it for 6 months just yelling from rooftops.
Yeah.
And I was close, and I was still hitting like generally the right target demo, but like, sometimes you just get surprised. And my favorite story about like that whole thing, I feel like I'm answering your question by saying, no, I don't listen to music, but like,
no, you're good.
My favorite story about that is a buddy of mine who doesn't listen to music. You know, he's just like, every once in a while, he'll find something on NPR. He's like, hey dude, have you ever heard of Mumford and Sons? It's like, yeah, they're, you know, like, good for you on discovering them on NPR. And, you know, this is 7 years ago, so that, but they were still like kind of a big deal at that point. He hit me up and he was like, I'm into this Head and the Heart band. And this is 10 years ago when they were first getting started. And wasn't a show that I had booked or anything, but I had heard the single once on the radio and been like, oh, this is actually a really cool song. And, but I just decided he wanted to go to the show and they were playing the Crowfoot. And I was like, yeah, we'll go to the Crowfoot. I'll take you. I can get you comps. This is before I even worked for the Crowfoot. I was just booking shows there.
Yeah.
And I purposely like built a wall around myself and was like, I'm just going to go in and see this band live. And that's going to be the first thought that I have of this band beyond hearing the one single one time.
Yeah.
And it was like a fun exercise for me to walk in and just like have them hit me in the face with like the best of themselves at a sold out Crowfoot show. And it was magic. It was absolute magic, you know? And so I'll even toy with myself with booking shows where I know that it's safe, that I understand what it is, but I still, I'm going to be like, or it's a support act that they add to the show that I don't have any say over. So I'm just like, I'm not even going to listen to who this is until I see it on stage.
Yeah. That's actually my favorite way to find a new band or like be introduced to a band is to go in completely cold.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel wrong about that, but I want to know what they're like live before I get attached. You put it perfectly the way you said you want to get hit in the face with it. That's exactly it. You know who hit me in the face was Bad Bad Hats when they opened up for Michigander.
Yeah.
I think that was at the Crowfoot.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know. I had no idea. I didn't know they were hilarious. I didn't.
She's hysterical.
Oh my God. And I was dying. Yep. And I'm a huge fan now. And I wouldn't have had that experience by just pulling them up on Spotify.
Yep.
So I really, you said it perfectly when you were like, you get the best of them. That's my favorite.
You want to absorb it in its full capacity. And that, yeah. I think that's one of the neat things about AudioTree that I really enjoy having come over here is that we have the ability with our digital, with our studio sessions that are on video to like show off the best part of a band.
Yeah, you do.
It also separates the ones that maybe can't play live yet. So there are definitely some folks that have played too early. And it's like, well, that didn't go so well. But like when I managed Flint Eastwood for years, we use their AudioTree session to like show people, put this band in front of people and this is what's going to happen. They're going to kick your ass. And, you know, there's been so many of those sessions and it's such a neat thing for us to be able to capture that live energy in a different way.
Yeah.
And it was obviously very important during the pandemic when we couldn't have the live, you know, to like have something at least to show people that says like, this is the best part of this band is, yes, the songs are good. Yes, the social media presence is good. You know, yes, the image is good and whatever else that you've heard about this band is good. But ultimately, it's about what happens on stage when they get in the room together and really tear it up. And Bad Bad Hats is a perfect example. We've got a show two shows this weekend with them, one at Otis Supply and one at Pyramid Scheme. And she tells the same jokes at every show. I didn't realize it until... But it's literally the same jokes every time. And they're freaking hilarious. They get funnier every time. Whether it's, the one about her being much like a combo or it's two pretzels with cheese inside. And then she's got one about, she goes back to that joke again and talks about how great hot dogs are, which is just like a tube of meat, sort of like my body, you know?
Oh, yeah, I do remember that one.
And, you know, she talks about, they've got a song called Detroit Basketball. So she tells the Detroit basketball story every time. And, you know, it's like the same routine, but it's always just so, it feels fresh every single time. And it's amazing. But
I'm
sad
to miss that show. I'm going to be out of town.
Yeah. To capture them in their like element, then you go backwards and start to discover the songs and you hear them. And I used to love live records and bootlegs in that way too, because I remember songs and the way that they're performed live. And then I'd hear the recording and you'd be like, you would like hit the note differently when you're singing it because you're used to hearing it on the live record.
Yeah.
But if you really get into the construction of it, you can see to where they've created this song to work on radio, but also like have the ability to do that live where they can like bend the note or they can take it to another level. And, you know, our buddy Michigander, I know you're going to see him tomorrow night.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple songs that he jams out at the end now that are kind of cool that are like, they're used, you know, he puts out such like crunchy 3.5 minute rock songs.
Yeah.
So to have a couple songs that they like take to another level at the end of it and really jam out for a minute or two is the exciting part, right? Because then you see it in that fashion and then you go back to it live and you're like, oh, this was the packaged version that had to be this way, but now I can see why this song was the song that they picked to take it like to that like set ending crescendo, you know, so to speak.
Yeah, I want to talk for a minute about what live shows you would download that weren't like the traditional like Grateful Dead, Allman Brothers, Dave Matthews Band, because
like
those,
the jam scene does that, right? Fish.
Yeah, they do it like it's like innate. Like if you're not recording your live shows and putting them up on Bandcamp or Nugs.net, then you're like falling behind in the jam scene. So, right. But I know that that's not your jam. So what other live shows were you downloading and bootlegging at the time? I'm super curious about that.
So it did start with Dave Matthews Band.
Okay. Yeah. I did that too.
But it wasn't the official releases. These are the ones that you'd find that you could download.
B's and P's.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And they were some were board recordings and some were live, you know, just live microphone recordings. And I never bootlegged any. I never got into like the taping. It was just too expensive for me. And I was just like, I'm not into this. But honestly, I went and saw Dave Matthews Band once with a friend who got it. And I didn't back in like 2001. They played two nights at Comerica Park. It was June 3rd, June 3rd there. And 4th. Yeah, June 3rd and 4th. And I went to one of the two, and I think I went the first night. And I went with this friend. She had an extra ticket or something. So I was like, yeah, I'll go with you. And the whole night I was like, man, they're going to play forever because they still got to play this song and this hit and this single and this single. And I just didn't understand that bands like went out and like just played, you know, whether it's a Pearl Jam or a Foo Fighters or whatever, like, you know, a lot of those nights, they just don't play the hit singles or whatever, you know, and Dave Matthews Band, obviously, is, right. You're known for that. So like, I'm sitting there, like we're 2.5 hours into the set. And I'm like, that's just going to go all night. What the hell? And then they just played like one more song and it was over. And it was like, well, wait a minute. They didn't play Crash. They didn't play Crash.
Yeah.
And I wasn't like a huge Dave Matthews. I wasn't like a big, like, you know, follow him around the country type thing, but it was something that me and my wife really grew to enjoy. So we probably saw him 4 or 5 times at that time. But this is the same time that I'm in college and Napster became a thing, and you just search for stuff. And I was a big like album folder organizer. So I had all my records that I had downloaded, but then you'd search for a band and you'd see like Dave Matthews Band 6301 Comerica Park. And I was like, what's this one track? And then you'd find the whole list and download. Yeah. And then now I've got an album, you know, and it's a live record. And from there, I don't exactly know like what was next, but I think I just started searching for like other bands that I love. Nirvana, I found a Matchbox 20 bootleg of something. And, you know, this is also around the same time where like VH1 Storytellers and MTV Unplugged were still big deals. So like the whole idea of like a live session, sort of like Audio Tree does now, was very prevalent in my mind. It's like, if I could get videos and tape when Fuel played on VH1 Storytellers, it was like, this is so sick. And they had to share the episode with Train, which sucked, but like, you know,
it's funny that you remember that. I don't remember Train being on that.
Yeah. And it was like, there was a thing called Farm Club, which is USA, which was Matt Pinfield, famous like rock DJ. He was the host of that. And they would do stuff like Limp Bizkit and Korn and Stained and Static X and like all those awesome Powerman 5000, like all the new metal bands from the late 90s, early 2000s. So there were all these things going on and you'd have to chase them down. They weren't just accessible to you like they are now,
right,
where everything's just on YouTube. And it's like,
you have to look in the paper TV guide and like see when they were going to be on next.
Yeah. And it was like, you'd wait all week and you'd go to tape it on Thursday night at 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't be on because it was preempted by some award show or baseball game or something.
Yeah.
Motherfucker. And you'd stay up till 1:30 in the morning to see if it would like play after sometimes. Yeah. But it was the same time sometimes you'd chase down and try to tape like when bands play on Letterman. But
yeah.
So all this like live obsession comes in with me right around college. I started going to shows in college, and the bootleg thing actually turned into an Our Lady Peace thing for me, which is my favorite band of all time. Like bar none. They've got 4 bad records that they put out. Like the last 4 are just like, but like everything before that was like, there's 6 records that are absolutely perfect to me.
Yeah.
And they were always one of my favorite live bands. They're definitely old guys, just like I am now. So it's not the same, but like, back then, man, they were just one of the baddest ass live bands ever was.
I saw him live once.
And yeah, I mean, he's all over the place. His vocal, you either love it or you hate it, but if you love it, you really love it. And he's super powerful with it. So I got into starting to find Our Lady Peace bootlegs, and I became like kind of the, I don't want to say the world's foremost, but like there was only so many people that were out looking for Our Lady Peace, and there was like me and 2 other people that were like collecting them and finding them. And it wasn't even, it was Napster, but then it started to be these other like peer-to-peer
Kazaa sites and stuff.
Yeah, LimeWire and Kazaa and all this stuff. And then eventually you get into torrents and things like that. But there was this thing called Direct Connect, and it was basically, you had like chat rooms where you'd go in and you could share any folders on your computer. It was just a direct peer-to-peer transfer network, but they were organized by themes, you know? So you could go in and download movies. You could go in and download computer games. There was plenty of porn to be had. There was all kinds of shit, you know, but it was by room. So you'd go into the Nirvana room, or you'd go into the Fish bootlegs room. And we started in Our Lady Peace. It was called a hub instead of a room. Okay. They called it a hub on Direct Connect. And we basically made it our mission to find every recording of Our Lady Peace that ever existed anywhere nice. In the world. And there was a website that ended up accompanying it, and a bunch of Our Lady Peace fans like connected. And eventually, like, two of them got married. They were all people that like met all throughout the world. And I was the guy that started that whole thing. And it's just like, that has become my MO through life, is like starting these like social gatherings of people with like minds. Right.
And yeah, that's cool. I like that.
It was I didn't even know I was doing it. It was just like a natural, like, I'm the guy who hosts the family Christmas party. And I was just like hosting this thing on the internet that I was obsessive enough about to like gather it all, you know, mm-hmm. and consume it in a way that was so ravenous that it was like, man, that guy's really friggin' serious about his Our Lady Peace bootlegs. And yeah. then from there, I had collections of other stuff, and they were on CDs and they were on my hard drives. And I don't even know where any of the stuff is now, but like, it was a whole moment, you know. It was probably 2 years of that. And then as things do, they calm down, the YouTube becomes a thing.
Yeah.
MP3s become iTunes becomes a thing. And it's like, okay, now I can't ravenously consume this in the same way that I did. The recording industry caught up with it. And
you were like a thought leader on all that stuff.
Sort of. Yeah, I guess. I mean, that, you know, I've always kind of had that bone in my body to like get a bunch of people marching in a direction, you know?
Yeah.
And so I've done it with songs. And that, I guess, was my first thing that I ever did with music that was any sort of leadership type of role. It's just like, we have all identified that we want to be in this group. Now, what does this group want to do with that power? You know?
I really liked Our Lady Peace in high school. I saw them when they toured. It probably would have been the summer of 99 or maybe even 98. They toured with Eve Six and Third Eye Blind, and it was like a triple bill. I saw them at Nautica in Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay. Nice.
I know that it was Eve Six, and I'm pretty sure it was Third Eye Blind.
See, Third Eye Blind and Eve Six, that's really funny that you say that. That was my first concert ever, was those two together at Hill Auditorium in Ann Arbor.
What year was it?
98, and they were doing the Campus Invasion tour in 1998.
I think maybe Our Lady Peace wasn't on your show, but they were on mine.
Yeah, it was just a two-band bill when I went, and I remember
look it up.
I remember thinking it was fall of 98, and I remember thinking, God, this band is awful.
Third Eye Blind.
Yeah, they were so bad live. Steven couldn't hit any of his notes. Eve Six was so much better that night, and now Eve Six is known for being a rambling and incoherent frontman, but Stephen Jenkins was really terrible that night. But then I went and saw Fuel that same week at St. Andrews.
Nice.
And it was like, at that point, I was just hooked in. So this is 98. Yeah, 98. And I probably saw in the last like 3 months of 98, I probably saw like 13, 15 shows, just like St. Andrews, Clutch Cargoes. And that's where it was. That's where it started for me. Like most people that are my contemporaries start with like, yeah, I was going to hall shows, you know, like hardcore at the local VFW, or like, you know, they have some like core root thing. And I'm like, oh, I was going to see Matchbox 20 at the EMU Convocation Center. And that's like where it started for me, which is super funny because then I've kind of worked backwards into like more DIY and punk and everything. But like, I was definitely just going to see hit makers like Everclear and Fuel and whoever.
Yeah, at me too.
St. Andrews State Theater, you know, like that's the lowest end of where it all started for me.
Yeah, yeah, I relate to that. I was trying to look up that tour and I couldn't find it. So I'm sorry if I looked distracted for a minute. But
no, you're good. I will find it because I am the researcher extraordinaire from all that stuff. And I've got a lot of like spreadsheets of like all my old shows and everything too. And a lot of the ticket stubs.
But Third Eye Blind, that first album is still so good from start to finish. And it makes me wonder, do you have the tape?
Yeah.
Yes, that's it. I was just listening. So the first podcast that I'm going to launch is, and by the time that this one airs, it will be out. It's going to be my essential songs. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't make an essential song list without putting God of Wine on it.
Mm-hmm. The last two tracks on that record.
Oh, man.
motorcycle drive-by yeah. and Gotta Wine are both yeah. classics. And they closed with Gotta Wine back then. I don't know if they still do, but
yes, yeah, but they did.
It was like, it still left, even though I was like, God, Stephen Jenkins is terrible. Like, it still left you with like that hum that you have and like that warm, fuzzy feeling. Because Gotta Wine is such a sick, like emotional wrecking song. So it was like, all right, yeah, he sucked, but man, that was still really good.
You know? Still really good. Yeah. And that was a song that they kind of jammed a little bit toward the end. And so I've been actually listening to Third Eye Blind like quite a bit this past week and trying to make sure that, you know, like I was like, all right, if I'm going to include a Third Eye Blind song, I have to make sure it's still good. Mm-hmm. Can't like listen
it
to
is
this.
They're it so is. Good
yeah
there's like two bad tracks on there, Erica, the one that mumbles on and on about vampires, and I'm not a big fan of Jumper, but like there's some deep Narcolepsy is a jam, Motorcycle Drive-By is a jam, there's so many. How's It Gonna Be is just a monster song, and then the second record and the third record are both like just full of hits and just so many deep cuts, and then I kind of feel like they lost the, you know, basically they Steven kicked everyone out of the band and now it's just him, you know, and it kind of lost like its magic. But man, talk about songs. If you want to start a podcast about songs, you can put quite a few Third Eye Blind songs in there as far as like, this is what songwriting should, you know.
Yeah. And the longevity of it. I mean, at this point, like he might've written some of those songs 25 years ago.
Yep.
I mean, it's definitely been 25 years. It might have even have been 30. I don't know when he wrote them, you know, but like they still sound fantastic. And I think like sometimes I think about covers and arrangements and like doing a song over again, but only if it needs to be done. And I don't think any Third Eye Blind songs need to be remade.
Oh,
like
hell
I don't know anybody who could do it better than they did.
Right.
Off the top of my head.
Yeah. And that's the thing that's special about songs, right? Is like, it's not like an A, B, A, B, C, A, B. It's like, what inflection points are there on different lines? And like I said, it's remembering how it was sung live on the live record and singing it that way when you hear it on the radio. You know, and even so far as to like, you know, Limp Bizkit just put a new record out this week. And I keep seeing tweets from people that are like, this record is legitimately good. And I'm like, I can't buy this. Like I had a phase, right? I had a whole new metal phase and I go back to it every once in a while. And there's certain ones that still like Seven Dust and Linkin Park and Finger 11 all still like hit for me, just like they did back in the day. But some of the cornier stuff, I'm like, oh God, I'm sorry. I had that phase in my life. But he's got... they broke that Stained song Outside, where it was just Aaron Lewis playing the acoustic guitar. And they put out a live version first on the Family Values soundtrack.
Yeah.
And Fred Durst comes out and sings the hook with him. Mm-hmm. And he says something like, Jacksonville, show me your lighters or something like that. And like, I say that every time I hear the song on the radio, even if it's the recorded, like the studio version, because it's like, man, that's where Fred says the thing about the lighters. Or, I'm really feeling them lighters or something like that.
Yeah. And
Our Lady Peace, I've got a live DVD that I still like insert like the little rain like isms in the middle. And Dave Matthews is a perfect example of like having all of these things that like they play a song differently live and every single fan knows, like during Warehouse, you do the woos and the, you know, it's like,
you'll be my Dixie chicken. I'll be your Dixie chicken. If you'll be my Tennessee lamb. Like,
Yep. Yeah. During Crash. And it's like that song, that's just like a 3.5 minute pop song, has a whole new take live and it sounds different. And
you know
that this song is the one with the violin solo and the one, this is the one with the sax solo. And
I miss the violin.
Well, can't do what that guy did.
I know hurts my heart. I don't know if you remember, but the Lily White sessions, the Dave Matthews Lily White sessions, all those songs had been played that whole summer. And that was the summer that I turned 18, so it was the first summer that I could get in my own car and like go to Columbus and go to Pittsburgh, and so I saw a lot of Dave Matthews Band that summer. And so I had heard all of them. And then he played My Hometown Shed Blossom on my 18th birthday. And it was like the best thing ever. They played Grey Street and Grace Is Gone. And, you know, and then he recorded all of them in the studio. And I listened to it like maybe once, maybe twice.
Yeah.
And then I just went right back to my birthday show, you know, and that's the CD that lived in my car because that was the one that made sense to me.
Yep. Yeah. And those songs, it's funny because those songs have the two different recorded. They have the Lillywhite sessions and then whatever the record was that was after Every Day, I think. Busted Stuff is the name of the record.
Okay.
And then they also have multiple live records that they've officially put out that have those songs on them, whether it's listener supported or whatever. So you're getting like three different versions of Grey Street now, and you're getting Grace Is Gone into Bartender. I didn't know that this would become a Dave Matthews Band podcast, but I'm feeling
we're just
it.
Talking
I'm
about feeling songs. It. Just songs.
Yeah. Yeah. But you just have these songs that take on these multiple like personalities somehow. And they're all that certain ones hit at certain times, you know, and it's really interesting. I've been watching, there's a show on Hulu. It's called Wu-Tang, An American Saga. And it's just about the Wu-Tang clan. It's a fictional biopic of the Wu-Tang coming up, and there's two seasons of it. It's really good if you're into like that 90s hip hop shit. And like the most recent the first season like builds up like where they came from is like young teenagers and like getting into trouble and gang shit and all that, and then a little bit of the music. And then the second season really works through like the first record, and like there's a whole song, there's a whole like the sixth episode of season two where RZA, who's the guy who brought Wu-Tang together, he's the one that does all the music and everything. They're writing Protect Your Neck, which is the first single.
Yeah.
And it's this like explosion of him dreaming and like in the studio, and they get into his head and they show him like taking the band members and like moving them around. Like, okay, I want you to play this beat, drummer. And like, then he brings in a second drummer and they're like, the two drummers are like talking to each other. Like, what are you doing here? Well, you play this. All right. And it's just like this, like imagined all in RZA's brain, like showing the song coming together.
Yeah.
And it's so good. I mean, each character has, you know, somebody playing them. Method Man has the rapper Dave East, who's like a pretty decent rapper of his own name. And Joey Badass is Inspector Deck, I think. And like, and then there's just some relatively like no name actors that are Ghostface Killah and GZA and RZA and all this. And they all just play the roles perfectly. That one is so like, just from the songwriting perspective, I would dig into that episode, even if you didn't watch the whole thing, because it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating because it just like literally shows what's going on in his brain. And like, he's playing the parts on his little synthesizer and you know, scratching on the records. And then he's got this drummer and this bass player, and then there's two drummers, and then they layer them, and then they bring in choir. And then it's like, just, it's,
I wish I thought like that.
Oh, I don't think like that. And that's why it was so fascinating to me. Cause it was just like, this is so awesome. I just hear people play songs and like, good job doing that. Like,
yeah, that made me feel good.
right. Yeah. But it's so good. So, so good. Then they do a live one, like two episodes later, they do their first live show.
Okay.
And it's a little corny, and it's like a New York club that like it's exclusive to get into, and the security doesn't let their friends in because they're from Staten Island. And then there's like guest list issues, and then there's payment issues. And then they end up bum rushing the stage because they get kicked off the bill. And it was like all this, like, I was like, none of this happens, but the songwriting episode was so good. And the live episode was so disappointing, but they do a pretty good job like walking through the music business in the late '80s, early '90s too, because it gets into like BMG and Def Jam and all the labels and how important college radio was back then and all of those things.
Yeah.
It's a really neat.
That's cool.
Yeah. There's a lot of business to be gleaned from that series. It's interesting because they negotiate their label deal, and they end up putting out the first record on a small label instead of, they were offered a Def Jam and an Elektra contract and a couple others, but then one of their dudes got arrested right before they were ready to sign, and a lot of the labels went like this and went, oh, I can't touch this. But they also talk about how RZA, when he brought them in and had them sign the contract to join the Wu-Tang group. Wu-Tang Productions was their like business. They made sure that each member maintained their solo rights to sign wherever they want. So Old Dirty Bastard and Ghostface Killah went out and like made deals. ODB went to Elektra and Ghostface, or Method Man went to Def Jam. And this is all shown in the show too. So it's,
and it's
like,
all true.
It's, yeah, it's, I mean, it's definitely like there's like
dramatized
some drama to it. Like RZA made the decisions for the group. Mm-hmm. So he signed ODB with Elektra because the deal was better. But oh, ODB okay. grew up wanting to be on Def Jam. It was like the only thing he ever wanted. He just wanted to be on Def Jam. He didn't care about the money. He didn't care about this. Like, I just want to be on Def Jam. And RZA made him sign, like signed him as member of Wu-Tang, where he controlled that part of it. He signed him to Elektra behind his back, and then like ODB jumps him in the subway and like they get in a fist fight, and I'm like, I don't know if they ever fought, you know what right. I mean?
Yeah. But all that other stuff is true. He really did like sign him to Elektra behind his back.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so like I've got the tape here and it's an Elektra tape, and I've got the tape of Method Man and it's on Def Jam. And there's an episode at the very last part of the episode, he has all the solo records that he's produced, and there's like a flood in the basement of his house that has, and it takes like all the records are just like the tapes are just floating in the water. And it's like Method Man's first record and ODB's first record and Ghostface's first record. And it's just like, it's super dramatic. And I'm like, I wonder if there was actually a flood.
Yeah.
Or if this is like a curveball they threw in. Because they've definitely thrown in a few curveballs where it's like, that never happened. They invented like a whole character, I guess, that like got killed outside of one of their apartment complexes when they were growing up. And it's like, this isn't, if you go in and read the Reddit afterwards, it's like, well, that's fictional. That guy never even existed. And they've admitted that. So they've taken some liberties, but
yeah.
So I wonder about, that's where they left it in the cliffhanger, was like the flood took out like all these Jizz's Liquid Swords and like these first recordings. So I don't know if the third season is them like re-recording all of that, or like if he salvages it or whatever. Yeah. And I'm like, fuck, I have a year to figure out. I hate that. Yeah. I've always hated that. Like, but at least with like broadcast TV, you used to know like this is a fall show. It's going to be next fall, or it's in the spring or whatever. Now with, I mean, Netflix, it's like, when are we going to see Stranger Things 4? It might be another year.
Yeah. The kids are going to be so old. They're going to look completely different. Like kids age so fast. And those kids were so young when it started, but that's another topic for another day. Can we talk about Flint Eastwood for a minute? Because she was actually, when I moved here, the first voice that I heard. And I would love to talk about that. So I
love talking about Jax.
Yeah, me too. That's the album I've been listening to the most lately, is Songs for Every Condition, the new one.
Yep.
But when I moved here, it was the end of 2011, and I got, you know, it took me a little while to get a car, and then I started going to like Sonic Lunch, and but like I don't think L Club was open yet, you know. It was different. Detroit was different in like the summer of 2012. So I gravitated toward Ann Arbor, and everything was just way mellower. My Dear Disco was changing their name to Ella Riot, and it was like everything was kind of in flux. Then I heard The Baptism with Passalacqua and Flint Eastwood, and it just cracked my world open to what was going on underground. I felt like it was underground in Detroit because it wasn't a big deal. It didn't feel like something that was like heavily advertised, I guess, for lack of a better word. And then I saw the video.
But like all the cool people knew.
Yeah.
That was like the crowd you needed to be part of somehow.
And I saw them walking that horse down the street in the video, and I heard Jax's voice and I heard the raps, and I was like, oh shit, like there's something really fucking cool going on here that I have to be a part of. And that was it for me, was that song in that moment. And so I'm kind of curious, how did you come into that role managing Flint Eastwood? And, you know, like, tell me the story of what took you there.
Yeah. So I heard about Flint Eastwood before they were Flint Eastwood. They were called Power.
Okay.
And they sent me just like a general booking email that said, hey, we're this band. We just moved back from LA. We're in Detroit. were called Power. Here's our song called Billy the Kid.
Okay. Was it just Jax and Seth or
who was it? It was Jax and Seth at that point. It was very much an electronic project. It was Jax had a shaved head. Seth had the same shaved head. They were in like this tribal makeup in this video, just like sweating at like a club. And it was this pulse. I don't know if you remember the song Billy the Kid, but
I'm gonna have to look it up.
This is the end. This is the end. And it was like this really pulsing, like it had like a, what do you call those giant drums? It's just like boom, 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 boom. And it had this pulsing like heat to it. And I had them open for something that didn't make sense. It was this band called Ann Horse at the Pike Room. And it was like a two-piece LGBT leaning indie rock. I think they might have even been like Australian or New Zealand or something.
Okay.
And Jax was really into them, I think. And just so I just kind of was like, this might work. And then found out that, you know, I listened to some other stuff too. There were some demos back then of some of the songs off that first Late Night in Bolo Ties EP. And there was a connection to, they had just done the film or something with To Write Love on Our Arms. So there was some like heat from that. But I just heard that song the first time and it was just like entrancing. It was just like, God. And that's a rarity, right? I talked about like the idea that like sometimes I just book stuff, especially locals, if they talk the talk properly and they kind of surround themselves with the right people, they're part of like the scene of the genre. Yeah. I'll give it 15 seconds and just be like, oh, this is cool. Yeah, this is fine. You know, close enough. This one like drew me in. I was like, whoa, this song is insane. And I don't know, it's like one of the few songs I can remember from a local act that I just immediately threw into like my listening habits, where it was like, I don't even know if Spotify was a thing at that point or if I downloaded it on iTunes or whatever it was, but it was like in my rotation.
Yeah. It was probably pre-Spotify because I think that I had to find the baptism on YouTube. I don't even think Spotify was around. I mean, I'm pretty sure we're talking about like 2013. You would be even earlier than that because they were calling themselves Flint Eastwood when I found them in like 13 or 14.
So this might've been 2012 when they did this. And then we had a show later in the year at the Crowfoot where it was a show about video game music.
Oh, cool.
Mostly. So it was like, what do you call that when they play like a band called I Fight Dragons?
Oh, yeah. The Goldberg soundtrack.
Yeah. And there was just like a bunch of bands.
Nintendo Core.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And some of them literally are playing like controllers and stuff. Right. Yeah. We had a whole show at the Crowfoot. It was like two stages, Pike Room and Ballroom, I Fight Dragons, the Protoben, a bunch of like these just nerdcore type rappers and stuff like that. And somehow I mixed Flint Eastwood into that because of the Billy the Kid soundtrack, the song just being so like dancey and pulsey and like it just made sense. So I put them on the main stage to open that show up and and at that point they had flipped from Power to Flint Eastwood and they just ripped. They brought like kind of that dancey feel, but then had rounded it out with a band at that point. And I don't remember who was in it at that point. It was still Jackson, Seth. And I know Seth was on stage, but that night I just remember us hanging out a lot and talking a lot about like where they're headed, where the vision is. And I just told him, I said, I'm in like whatever the hell this band wants to do, I need to be a part of. So we booked him a few more times in Michigan and through that just became friends. And then I eventually, you know, at some point went to Assemble or went to I don't know, we had dinner or something. And I was like, I want to manage you because I do that sometimes poorly. And you look like you need some, you know, like,
it was always help. Let me help.
It was always a side gig thing for me, you know, managing. And I'd just gotten done managing Koji and somehow their worlds crossed over to Koji's like Asian songwriter from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, who toured solo and did a whole lot of like advocacy work and just a really passionate human being. But he had done some work with La Dispute and kind of in that scene, but like also had this like folky thing where he did tours with like Kevin Devine and stuff. And he just, but he also knew all the filmmakers in Michigan through his work. And like, Jax is obviously very involved in all of that stuff. So Jerry Wald and Shane Ford were like kind of into what Koji was doing and what we were doing with Fusion. And then also very into Jax. So I would run into Jax in these places where it was like, okay, you're at the factory in Rochester now, and yeah. you're at the Crowfoot, and you're downtown doing this stuff with this rap group called Passalacqua.
Yeah.
And like all of this stuff. And it's just like, Jax is every freaking where,
yeah.
you know, and you yeah. couldn't miss her. And it was like, then you get in a room with her and you have a conversation with her and you can't help but like want to run through a brick wall. Right.
Yeah, so yeah. She's the best.
We just ran through brick walls where we could for 3 years. We ran into a bunch of brick walls that we couldn't run through. And at a certain point, you know, like as has always been the case with me and management, and it just run out of, I live here. I live in Heartland, Michigan. I'm not yeah. in the conversations to like take you to the next level. So right. like Jax and I just run to a point like we couldn't do anything further together. So we worked on yeah. getting her a new manager and all that kind of stuff. And that's when she got to play Lala and do all the, you know, cool stuff like cool. that, really start like building a national fan base as opposed to like a regional thing. But
yeah, but that first stuff is so important though, because you're not just like managing the artist, you are developing the business and developing the career and
yep.
laying the foundation and helping the artist gain the confidence to move to that next level without you.
Yep.
Because it's like, you know, like as a parent, you're training your kid to be able to load the dishwasher by themselves when they go to college. And it's not like parental in the same way, but it's the same kind of like training idea where it's like you're gonna need to do this, you're gonna need to advocate for yourself.
Yeah,
so I'm gonna advocate for you as loudly as I can, and I want you to hear me and remember what I'm saying, and then be able to go out and say it for yourself when I'm not with you.
Yeah. And it is, I mean, parental is the perfect, I mean, you say it's not, but it totally is. It with Jax now, like I've still got this like father figure role in her life where she'll like come to me with heavy stuff, you know, and yeah. it's like, I may not have heard from her for 6 months other than like the occasional text or, you know, we still yeah. like retweet each other's stuff and like, of course, you know, yeah. send little Instagram messages, but then she's like, hey, do you want to meet up, and then we'll go sit at like some restaurant, and we'll go for like 4 hours and both be sobbing about our lives and whatever. Yeah. And you know, it's just like we've been through some shit. And so even though like the official manager role leaves, you still have this like personal tie to this person and yeah. how they're trying to figure out as now like going from like a young adult to like a middle-aged adult, like how yeah. the hell do I continue to do this? You know, like yeah. it never exploded to the point where like I can just bankroll a bunch of money that I had from before. It's just like there's so much success, but there's also so much just like day to day where it's like, where's my next paycheck coming from? And
yeah,
you know, converting to that type of artist where you know that like it never got like Halsey big, you know, right. it never got Florence and the Machine big. It just got like sold out Shubas and sold out.
Yeah.
you know, L Club big. And that's great. That's amazing. Yeah. That's so much more than so many people have done. But trying to like balance that with the fact that like you can sell out a room like that and that money's gone like this. You know, yeah. it's like when we got a, you know, a stimulus check. It was like, oh, I'll do this with it, that with it. And then you're like, you spend yeah. it the first day on like a bill. And you're like,
yeah. You're like, cool, cool. Well, I'm caught up now.
Right. Yeah. Maybe
I get to keep my house.
Right. Right. Yeah. And in her case, like I just paid for all the records that I bought and owed somebody right. for, or whatever it is, you know,
right,
it's like,
yeah.
So, you know, we work through a lot of that stuff, but a lot of it's just like the emotional side of it too, you know, where you just work through like, are people going to care about the new music that I put out? Or like, how do I make this? How do I justify doing this when I could be doing this and doing that? You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's yeah. being independent in general. And I mean, I know, you know, this shit from as well as anybody. I mean, you've made multiple career moves recently and knowing how to like make it all pay the bills and still maintain that like independent entrepreneurial spirit.
It's hard though.
I mean, like it's a freaking battle.
It's a grind.
And it's almost as if building your financial ability to make money off of people that are struggling to find a way to make money is a tough biz, you know? And I feel that, you know, it's like managing an act that isn't popping, you know?
Yeah.
It's like this doesn't pay for itself. It doesn't pay for itself for anybody. So if it's not paying for itself for the artist, it's not paying for itself for the team. And that goes to the coaches and to the financial, the business managers and the, you know, it's like, it's just a percentage, you know, ultimately if it's not, and again, it goes back to like what the definition of success is, you know, because you can look at what Jason's doing right now with Michigander. You can look at Jax's career. You can look at a lot of these folks, Mike Maines and the Branches and Tunde and all them. And it's like, they've all had incredible like peaks and wonderful moments and even sustained like a couple of years of really great, like, but it's like, how do you do that all the time, constantly? And it becomes it's a struggle, you know, like you are not only competing with every artist in the world, but now you're competing with Netflix, you're competing with Xbox, you're competing with Fortnite, you're competing with sex, you're competing with pizza, you're competing with like all, I mean, literally anything that people do to entertain themselves, you're in competition with on a daily basis. And if you can't admit that, stand up to it and tackle that task, you fall behind immediately, and that's exhausting. Not to mention playing like competition with your own track record, you know what I mean? And I'm sure it's exhausting. Even Our Lady Peace, you know, where it's like, man, you play all the old songs, it's like, well, these songs are better. It's like, well, are they? It's like, what kind of better? I don't know if they're better, but you know, you're never gonna beat the first record in most cases, you know. Wu-Tang's never going to have a bigger record than their first one, you know?
No, they're not. Yeah, and like finding something that you're good at doing and that you're passionate about and finding a way to transcend just one task or one event. Like, I think, I don't know if we actually talked about this, but I was worried about you at the beginning of the pandemic because you weren't booking shows. And I was like, what's Nate going to do if he's not booking shows? And then you started community building. And I was like, oh yeah, that's right. That's what Nate does. Nate brings people together. It doesn't matter whether it's online for Zoom calls or for venue associations or for shows or for festivals, Nate brings people together and Nate's going to be just fine, you know, but like,
it's good that you thought that, because I'm not sure I even thought that. I mean,
I tried to tell you.
Yeah, well, you put on a good face for stuff like that, but ultimately, like, the payoff for the things that we do, whether it's you helping a band navigate the business side and the tax side and the financial side and all that, or whether it's me, you know, trying to get a show sold out or whatever, it's like the payoff is in the moment of triumph, right? And it's, in my world, it's the live show when we get there and the people are there. And when that was ripped away from me for 17 months, and like there was no replacement for it. As much as we were doing streaming shows and Zoom this and, you know, all these little things to like bring people together as best we could, literally the one thing we weren't allowed to do was the thing that was the emotional payoff, and not only emotional, but also ended up being the financial payoff. And those things are tied together because we pay for emotional payoffs. You know,
we sure do.
we pay for good meals. We pay for good music. We pay for good movies. We, you know, but like, if you don't have the thing, if you don't have the food, I'm not going to go to a restaurant, you know? And if I don't have, and if it's not hot or if it's not fresh or it's not whatever, and it comes home in a foam box, like, and it's 20 minutes
soggy
later.
Tacos.
Yeah. Like that. It's just not the same. So you can't, you know, certain places are built for it. My wife, I go from places to people, but like my wife is built for what we've gone through in the last few years. And I know she's had her own stresses and whatever, but like, she likes to be home. Mm. She likes to be around her stuff and her TV shows and her family and her people. And, you know, like, she was built for this. I'm built to like be the one that turned the key to make this moment happen amongst a gathering of people in a space. And I have no idea how much that would break my goddamn heart when it was taken away from me. And not like in a, in a little way, but in like an extreme, like door shut and locked, and you have no idea if that door is ever going to open again. No. You know,
it did and open though.
It did, and it.
I know it's not the same.
It feels good. It does feel good right now, though. You know, yeah. We have an obscene number of shows this month. Just absolutely.
Yeah, I saw crazy, your Instagram post. It was like so tiny. I was like, there's so many shows.
Right.
I'm like zooming in.
And it's great because it feels relatively normal, but like, you know, and I know that behind the scenes, like an already fraught low margin industry is even more fraught yeah. and more low margin. And
yeah.
But if nothing else, after 17 months of it being taken away, I appreciate every little piece of it so much more.
That's you know? Great. Yeah.
And so every win is bigger emotionally, even if the win isn't bigger financially. Unfortunately, the losses hurt more now too, you know, because it's like, we're already down. How the hell yeah. could you take more away from me?
Yeah.
And I'm sure we're all feeling that, but the wins are real, even like a moderate win just feels like a warm hug, you know? And it's like, I will hopefully not lose sight of that as things come back. You know, I don't think yeah. there's ever going to be a normal. Normal has been redefined, right? And yeah. it's like the new normal, which I freaking hate that yeah. phrase, but like,
yeah, it's become truth. A cliche now. No,
yeah, yeah, but it's absolutely the truth, right?
Well, we'll get back out there. I'll see you at a show one of these days, and it's going to feel really good and be really fun. And yeah. the artist is going to tell jokes, and the front man's going to make mistakes. And
yeah, well, hey, you've got the ultimate. If it's really your first show back, going to see Michigander tomorrow yeah. night, like that one.
It's my first home. Indoor show.
Right. Yeah, and that one hit home for me when we had him in Grand Rapids last week. I was there, yeah. and it was an obscene number of hugs,
yeah,
an obscene number of smiling faces that you haven't seen in person in a very long time, an obscene number of like moments on stage where you're like, yep, that's why I'm here. That's yeah. like the validation, you know?
Yeah.
And it is that emotional payoff. You're going to feel it in spades tomorrow night. And I encourage you to like, how to say it? We were arriving later and leaving earlier than we ever have in this time because of like our anxieties and our fears of like, I got to get home. I got to get out of this. I got to,
yeah.
Like I'm trying really hard to like, get there earlier, stay mm-hmm. later, like be more present and not yeah. like I'm gonna skip the opening acts or I'm gonna go downstairs and get pizza. Like get the pizza after the show because that pizza is okay. gonna be just as good at 11:30 as it'll yeah. be during like Jake LaMond's set. But you're gonna yeah. watch Jake LaMond and you
do it all. Yeah. Well, I really like, love Kylie, so yeah. I wouldn't miss Jake LaMond's
yeah.
set.
Anyway. Yeah, and it's like you're going to glean more things from those things that you're not expecting. You know what you're going to get from Michigander's show, but I think yeah. you're going to get it more than you've ever gotten it. But it's those other moments that you're going to appreciate so much more as you look around the room. And you're already somebody who has vision. Like I know that you walk into a room and you appreciate what's going on behind the scenes, you know,
oh, yeah.
you appreciate the sound, you appreciate the bartenders, you appreciate everybody that's hustling and moving, but you'll see it in a way that like, is more moving than you're used to. And that's a really cool thing for me to be able to be like, yo, that bar back is hustling and I love yeah. it, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know. It's wild. And maybe that wears off a little bit after a while, you know, when the grind comes back, but I'm feeling it right now and I'm making notes of it. And I'm saying it out loud when I yeah. notice someone hustling. I'm like, you killed it today. I was at a wedding for the first time and since my first pandemic wedding, I guess a couple yeah. weekends ago. And I went into the catering like back area where they had been serving us all night. And I just went in, I said, I want you guys to know like everything was incredible tonight. You guys did killer work. And I can tell that you're like hustling. You might be a little understaffed, but food was awesome and everything was great. And you had a smile on your face and I never saw you stop. Like, this is real. And
that's awesome that you did
just
that.
Like, they were just like, I was like trying to throw down a tip, you know, for these kids or something.
Take my money.
Right. It was just like, they were busting ass. And it just, yeah. you know, if we that's all great. Come into it, it's weird because like, you know this, I mean, I've been bitching about school board stuff and all that stuff lately.
Yeah.
There's such an angry group of people out there that's like that all the time. And then there's these people, I feel like on quote unquote our side of things that are like more loving, more appreciative, more thoughtful, tipping better than they ever did, you know, like all of these things. And like, if that is what comes out of this last 2 years, we'll be fine.
Yes.
We may not be fine. We may not be fine as like a country. We may not be fine as individual like states and cities and counties and school districts and whatever, but like, we're going to take care of each other like this. And if that means that like this half doesn't get taken care of because they don't want to play ball like that, but we're going to take care of the people that like mean something to us, you know what I mean? So we're going to see that person at the show or at the wedding, just busting their ass. And we're going to go out of our way to be like, yo, usually I tip 20%, here's 40, you know?
Like, yeah.
I'm going to get that email in the morning that says like, did you accidentally tip this month? Yes, I did.
That's real. Yeah.
Yes, I did. Capital One. Thanks for pointing it out for me. A little pat on the back the next morning.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. So. All right, Nate, you're awesome.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, you too.
When you said this will be an hour, I'm like, no, that's not how.
I do have to go to bed though.
Yes, my podcast was like 2.5 every episode. It just got worse every week. So feel free to press the red button like I always do with my daughter. I'm like, all right, honey, push the red button.
Yeah, we gotta go now. But, I want you to come back. Yeah, please. Once I get into the swing of this a little bit more and start to crack open some different topics, and I have this whole list of questions we didn't even talk about, so
I've got it up here like waiting for them to start coming down.
I didn't need to
I want to do the song review thing too, so like definitely bring me in. I'd be happy to do any of that kind of panel type stuff or just like helping young musicians get started. I love that stuff. So
awesome,
enjoy the show tomorrow night. Feel it for me. Give Jason a hug, and
I'm definitely gonna cry. I like
good
I actually saw him at Sonic Lunch and I cried, and it was like the middle of the afternoon and my kids were like, Mom, can we leave? It's too loud. I'm bored. Can we go home? And I'm like, stop it. I'm having a moment.
I'm having a fucking moment over here. But love it.
Yeah. So it'll be fun tomorrow. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for having me on, and
thanks for coming.
We'll be in touch soon, Steph.
Definitely. Thank you so much. Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye. This episode of When Songs Mean Business is a production of Steph Belcher Business Management, LLC. This episode is hosted, produced, and edited by Stephanie Belcher. Please follow us on Instagram at When Songs Mean Business and join our Facebook group, When Songs Mean Business. Thanks again to everybody for listening, and take care.